Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering. Guys, why are you braving supermarkets with psychopaths who want to kill each other with knives for toilet paper? I may be slightly exaggerating, but the apocalypse is only just kicking off. We're at the beginning of the Mad Max stuff right now. So while we can, go to bellacatering.com.au, get the most beautiful home-cooked meals from one of Sydney's best catering companies, therefore one of Australia's best catering companies, and have it driven to your house. You can feed your family here in self-isolation, throw some stuff in the fridge, eat some leftovers, don't go out there and brave it if you don't have to, and you don't necessarily want to order a big takeout. You can do it all at home. They're great. This is my little way to help Glenn and Maria and their team who have pivoted to home delivery from catering because of the big shutdowns. Get onto that. bellacatering.com.au. Now, onto the show. When producer and star Robert Redford shopped All the President's Men around to the studios in the mid-1970s, his pitch was met with almost universal indifference. In addition to the conventional wisdom that political subjects are box office poison, All the President's Men had the problem of being based on an historical moment. The Watergate break-in and cover-up, so recent everyone already knew the ending of the story and was sick of hearing about it. Redford believed in the project and refused to take no for an answer. However, and 8 Oscar nominations and several million-dollar box office dollars later, his passion was vindicated. Redford's feeling all along that audiences might be familiar with the broad strokes of the Watergate story and its role in forcing President Nixon to resign, but that the narrative could be made fresh by following the young journalist whose dogged investigative reporting broke the story. Bob Woodward, played by Redford, and Carl Bernstein, Dustin Hoffman, were opposites thrust together by the Watergate scandal, which would become the defining moment of not only the country, but also for their careers.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is a filmmaker, a film historian, one of the great, and this a person of significant envy when you're sitting over in Sydney, Australia, doing podcasts and following people online and seeing this man's name regularly interviewing some of the greatest filmmakers and actors who currently are alive and working today. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome someone with a research ethos that's coming to this show and just a dynamic film mind. You would have heard him on One Heat Minute Productions already in the longest episode of Increment Vice to date. He is the incredible Jim Hemphill. Jim, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So here we are, All the President's Men, 1976. You wrote, people would have heard at the beginning of this show, because that is how the show is introduced, your American cinematographer's discussion of All the President's Men that you funnily said you didn't even really remember writing. I just wanted to ask you, you know, what's your relationship been with All the President's Men? As a, you know, I know that you're a fastidious guy when it comes to craft. So where does All the President's Men stand up for you in that absolute logjam of kind of definitive and incredible American films in the 70s?
It's pretty high up there. And part of it is just a matter of circumstances in terms of how I discovered it. You know, when I was a kid, I grew up in the, you know, the Betamax, even the Betamax age before the VHS age.
I mean, yes.
My family, we got a Betamax machine probably when I was around 8 years old or something like that, 7 or 8 years old, and it was still pretty early on. And in those days, where I lived, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and movies on video were not that accessible. You know, there wasn't that much stuff available yet. So I, the only place to get movies to watch on our VCR was the local library in our town, and they only had about 25 movies. So in a way, my sort of young film education was kind of curated by a local librarian. So, you know, I didn't necessarily, it's not like today, like I sort of envy and feel sorry for kids today who grew up as movie fans and have access to so much at the click of a button, because there's something kind of romantic about not having easy access to stuff. But anyway, so one of the movies
couldn't agree more that the intimidation of a movie library online is what way less than a shelf. Like, one of the things that I think we can all agree on, if you ever go away to a holiday and you stay with family or friends or a holiday house and it has a tiny shelf with a very limited selection of books or movies, like, it's nice because you go, oh,
yeah,
well, I only have these books to read. That's great. That's nice.
Yeah. And so anyway, so as a kid, I think, like I said, probably around 8 years old or something when I saw Frozen Spinner for the first time, it would have been because go to the local library, have a typed list of the movies they had, and you would say, oh, I want to watch Annie Hall or Alien or whatever, and they would go back to the back in a room and come back with your Betamax copy of one of those movies. And so, you know, I basically, as a kid, just went down the list, and All the President's Men was one of the movies they had. And so I saw that at around 7 years old, you know, in a way too young to understand it, but for some reason, and I'm not sure why, as a kid, I was obsessed with journalism movies. Like, because another movie that was really big for me at the time was Absence of Malice, the Sidney Pollack movie that came out in theater at around the time when I discovered All President's Men on video. And I was really into that movie. And for the life of me now, I look back and I can't figure out what I was getting out of these movies at 7 or 8 years old. But for some reason, I was very obsessed with them. And All the President's Men, I remember there was something about it that was... The funny thing to me now is, so this would have been probably somewhere around 1980 or 81, and All the President's Men then to me felt as far away as, you know, Ben-Hur or something. And I mean, it was probably only about 5 years old. But that felt to me, it felt like an old movie because it was more than half of my life. So I checked the movie out of the library and watched it and came completely obsessed with it as a kid, and have remained obsessed with it my entire life for a number of reasons. I mean, I think one being, one of the things obsessed me as a kid, still obsessed to this day, which is trying to sort of figure out what it is about this movie that makes it, what it is about Pecula's filmmaking and the performances and Gordon Willis' cinematography that makes it so riveting. It is essentially just a movie about guys driving around, going from room to room, talking to people and looking through, you know, sheets of, you know, little slips of paper and all this. I mean, there's this way, and especially, and again, where everyone knows the ending. It's like, this is not a movie that should, and I've heard, you know, people have talked about this to varying degrees on your podcast already, and people like Soderbergh have talked about it over the years. There's just something amazing about how riveting this movie is, and it absolutely shouldn't be. And there are other movies that I don't find riveting the same way that are kind of similar. Like, you know, for example, I like the movie Apollo 13, but that's a movie where knowing ending, I never was drawn into it the way that I was as a kid seeing All the President's Men, and the way I still am, even though I've seen the movie now probably 20 or 25 times. And now I've got some theories about it, but as a kid, I was completely mesmerized, and it's sort of, in a way, my, you asked about it in its like sort of role in the pantheon of 70s movies. As a kid, that movie was kind of my gateway drug to 70s movies.
Yes.
You know, it was the first Robert Redford movie I think I saw maybe except for Electric Horseman, another kind of journalism movie, but I think I saw Electric Horseman in the theater. So maybe that was the first Redford movie I saw. But All President's Men would have been like the second Redford movie I saw. Might have been the first Dustin Hoffman movie I saw. Certainly was the first Alan J. Pakula movie I saw.
Yes.
And it sort of sent me on a path of wanting to find all the other movies by those guys. You know, I became obsessed as a kid with the Redford movies, the Hoffman movies. And I also, because I didn't really understand the movie completely, then I went to the same library and checked out the book, All the President's Men, which was the first book I ever read in my life about politics or about journalism. So and that got me, that got me interested in reading other books. Stuff like that. So, All the President's Men as a movie was huge in my life in terms of my interest both in 70s movies and politics.
And it's so interesting that you say that it becomes a gateway drug for the 70s, and it becomes a gateway drug for American politics, and it becomes a gateway drug for that. And it's so strange also because you talk about something that's like elemental. You know, I think people reference it with kids a lot, like you forget those organic ways that you experience films. But this is a film that doesn't lose any of its luster for me either. And I don't know quite what that is. I'd be loving to hear your theories. Is that, and that's part of the impetus of this entire show, is to sort of continue to unpack. There are movies like, you know, and cut from the same cloth, like a Spotlight, where you know exactly what the outcome is. And they're trying to do it in the same way, and it does not pack nearly the same punch. And some would argue it has got, like, greater dramatic crescendos. There's greater, impact and affect of the reporting that is actually exhibited in the film than, say, the Woodward and Bernstein focus here that that Bill Goldman ultimately focused on, and Pakula and Redford were sort of crafted in that. So it's really strange. It's just this, but there is something addictive. It has an addictive quality to the way that it flows, and Pakula's work has that in spades. Like movies that shouldn't be as good, but he is so masterful at sort of like eking out every last emotion that you have in connection with it. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's this weird hypnotic thing.
Yeah, I think Pakula's the mastery of craft is certainly a big part of it. It's funny, like Spotlight, or I think sometimes about other movies. So whenever Aaron Sorkin does a movie like this, like Social Network or Moneyball, he always kind of gins it up with this. He always adds like a kind of interpersonal thing, like like Social Network has got there's the whole thing with the Rooney Mara character, and Moneyball, I don't remember that well, but I remember it had something to do with Brad Pitt's like daughter or something like that. You know, All the President's Men has nothing like that. I mean, you get no sense really of these guys having any kind of personal lives at all. I mean, you get the sense that Bernstein's maybe a little bit of a flirt and whatever, but it is just purely a process movie. And on the one hand, I think that's part of what makes it so fascinating and so addicting. And again, I'm always interested in. I've spent my whole life sort of looking under the hood of this movie and trying to figure out why it works. Because you would think theoretically, a movie like Social Network or a movie like Bombshell would work better because of the fact that they kind of dramatize certain things and theoretically are sort of following the quote unquote rules of dramatic structure more or something like that. But for whatever reason, All the President's Men is more addicting, and I think it does have a lot to do with Pakula and Gordon Willis. Just there's hypnotic is the perfect word when you said that, and I think a lot of it has to do with the way the movie is shot and framed. I mean, there is All the President's Men. You know, there is a lot of camera movement, but it's all very, very sort of locked down. Nowadays, so there's this sort of cliche in American movies now, I think, where, you know, they think it's more real or it's more journalistic if the camera is handheld, if it looks like, you know, it's kind of darting around trying to find the action. And you have none of that in All President's Men. Like, it is a very, very precisely designed, precisely framed movie. And
one cannot even imagine. One cannot even imagine like Peter Berg working with Gordon Willis. Like, hey, I want three cameras shooting all at the same time, and we're just going to pick up the best action. No stand-ins. We want all the actors there. You know, that Friday Night Lights style. It's right. Like you imagine that Gordon Willis was already freaked out people moving in the frame with Coppola in Godfather and Godfather Part 2. So like that over it feels like it's trying to create a kinetic energy in the movement that's happening in the frame or the movement of the camera rather than being very purposeful with the way that it's sort of emphasizing what is in the frame.
Yeah, and I mean this is a matter of taste because obviously, you know, like I don't really like Paul Greengrass's movies, for example, which, yes. You know, he's also that kind of what Gordon Willis calls dump truck directing. I mean, look, there are some movies that do it and do it very well that I like. I mean, I've actually really liked some of Peter Berg's movies, whatever. But for my own personal taste, I do tend much more toward the Pecula Willis approach, where in All the President's Men, I think, you know, Willis talks a lot about how he believes in contrasts, and the rhythm of All the President's Men visually, the visual structure of the movie is really interesting because it kind of alternates between these frames where, you know, they use a lot of split diopters. So you get a lot of depth of field in the frame where you see, you know, Redford will be on the phone in the foreground. And then in the background, you'll see in crisp focus, other things going on in the newsroom. And you alternate between frames like that, where your eye can kind of go wherever you want it to. And that, in my opinion, creates its own kind of attentiveness. Like I'm drawn more into a frame where I can't, you would think it's sort of counterintuitive. Like you would think that you'd be more drawn to a frame where the director is kind of guiding your eye to where he wants it. But in my opinion, when you have a frame where you can kind of pick and choose different parts to look at, it makes you more attentive. And then on top of that, Pecula alternates it with scenes like the first scene between Redford and Deep Throat in the garage, where it's the exact opposite. Like the focus is so shallow. You see the actors are in perfect focus, but then you can't see anything else in the garage. It's like everything else kind of bleeds into this abstract blur of blackness and kind of smeary lights in the background. And, you know, Pecula is just masterful at knowing how to kind of alternate those kinds of frames, knowing how to alternate close-ups versus these massive scenes where the characters are kind of dwarfed by the Washington, D.C. architecture. Like there's this kind of constant contrast of different styles of imagery. And I think that's part of what brings – that's part of where that hypnotic quality you talk about comes from. And it's just – and a lot of his movies have it. A lot of Pecula's movies have it. I mean, I think, you know, Clute has it. Parallax View has it. I mean,
Parallax has it in, as far as scale as well, has it in spades because the architecture is so quintessential to Parallax, like dams and huge, you know, buildings with spires and then like these tiny little dingy, you know, journalistic offices and then these little outpost kind of police headquarters and sheriff's offices and things like that have got bedrooms in them and things like that. You know, it's like, architecture and then complementing characters in spaces and a whole raft of different tools in his toolbox are what really, for me, like that's, you know, that really starts to get you every single time. And I like how you said you get to become a bit of a tourist with every single scene because you can sort of place your eyes in the frame wherever you want and it's rich. There's not like dead spaces, like they're alive with detail.
Yeah, there's amazing detail in that movie. I mean, that whole, that whole enormous Washington Post set that they built. I mean, you know, the more you watch the movie, you know, the first couple times you watch the movie when they do have those kind of deep focus shots, it's like you're probably looking at Woodward or Bernstein in the foreground on the phone. But then as you watch the movie more and you look in the background, you realize like just how masterful Pecula is and the production designer are just like filling the frame with detail and the detail, the sort of convincing activity of the background actors. I mean, it really looks like, you know, everyone in the background, they look like they have a purpose. Like one thing that kind of drives me crazy in contemporary movies about like lately, for some reason, I've been seeing a lot of new movies that are set in kind of newsrooms or like BuzzFeed-esque offices or something. Like I was just watching that movie Dexy. And then the other day I saw The Photograph, which is also a movie about journalism. And yes. these movies, you know, you look at the people in the background, they don't look like they're doing anything. and maybe, who knows, maybe that's more realistic in a way. I mean, maybe that's what it really would look like. I don't know. But
Pecula, you need more people looking at Twitter. That's just what you need. You need so many people hovered around. Is this a perfectly crafted tweet? Yes, it is. People doing selfies. I mean, I guess, like, if we're going to do it, let's go hard. Like, let's actually make it what it's like.
And I mean, granted, it's unfair in a way to compare those movies to All the President's Men for all kinds of reasons, and including the fact that it's totally different time. And in fact, you know, I mean, All the President's Men is, I think, another reason it's a movie that endures and the people love it. I mean, first of all, it's a movie, you know, it's a movie that not only filmmakers love, but in particular people who write about film love. And I think it is because there's this romantic notion of journalism in a way that, like, you know, it's funny. I heard someone criticize the movie Nightcrawler because they found it weird that when the Jake Gyllenhaal character goes to these news stations in the middle of the night, there's like no one in them. And actually, that's completely realistic.
Completely.
I mean, the times that I have visited, you know, I directed this movie with that Leah Thompson was in, and when we were going around to film festivals with it, I would sometimes tag along with her when she would go to like local news stations to do interviews promoting the movie or whatever. And I was always shocked when we would go to these news stations and she would go on these TV shows. I was shocked at how few people were involved in the making of these news broadcasts, that like the cameras were all automated and you'd walk in and these places would be just completely deserted.
Yeah.
And All the President's Men has this kind of, I don't know, I haven't been to like the LA Times lately or anything, so I don't know what the offices are like there nowadays. But there's this very romantic aspect to All the President's Men of the His Girl Friday-esque newsroom of just like this, you know, this newsroom where everyone seems really busy. And you get the impression that, you know, in the background, there could be any number of other important stories that all of these people are working on. And they're all these intrepid, you know, reporters. And I think it's certainly a movie that now, it's funny because I watched it again this week knowing I was going to be talking to you, and I hadn't watched it, I don't think, since the beginning of the Trump administration.
Yes.
And it really, really resonated in a way now, because I think there's that, you know, now with Trump administration and all the work journalists are trying to do and how much they're under siege by him and everything else, I think the romanticism of that has like a whole newfound appeal. And I'm kind of jumping all over the place here, trying to pin down all the things I love about it. But that it certainly has, like, you know, I mean, I always say about period movies, you know, a good period movie is about the period in which it takes place and the period in which it was made. And a great period movie is about the time in which it takes place, the time in which it was made, and the time in which you're watching it, you know? So like,
yes.
so like a great period movie, no matter when you watch it, will have some kind of resonance. Like, I always think about John Ford's Stagecoach, which was made in 1939.
Yes.
And I remember watching Stagecoach like during the 2012 election here in America. And, you know, the banker like comes on and starts giving this like rant in Stagecoach about, you know, about a businessman should be president and all this kind of, it could be like a Mitt Romney campaign stump speech. And All the President's Men, I think, has a little of that. Like, I think All the President's Men, whenever, you know, because the things All the President's Men are about in terms of power and the abuses of power and whether or not power can be held accountable and the sort of perennial appeal of the little guy who can triumph over power, which I believe in a lot less now than I did as a kid, and that I believe was possible in the Nixon era and all that kind of stuff. But all of those things have a very timeless appeal. And so I think that movie, no matter when you watch it, it's going to speak to you in a different way.
Yeah. A man that you've spoken to a couple of times, Mr. Quentin Tarantino, I had a chance to interview him in Oz in the wake of The Hateful Eight. And he said a very similar thing to me. It was something that just was so clear in his articulation was, you know, a Western is as much about, you know, he's talking about Western genre. A Western is as much about the period that it is set as the period that it is filmed. And I think exactly the wrinkle that you've added there is that about great films is that especially in the Western genre, as an example, or a journalism genre that still has implications to today, is that it continues to have a dialogue with you right now as well, and speaks as much to that. And, you know, the John Ford example of Stagecoach is so wonderful, but I think a lot about the Searchers. I think a lot about the Searchers a lot as a definitive Western, and think about what that's saying about the American culture and especially Southern American culture and post-Civil War biases that continue to sort of influence American culture. And I watch it all the time and I think, man, that no wonder Westerns almost had to pivot into revisionist after the Searchers, because what else was there left to say? Like, John Ford and John Wayne just went, we're done. This job is done. We're closing it out.
And the Searchers, I mean, and the other interesting thing about Westerns of that era, I mean, the Searchers, I agree with you. It's a movie that you could watch. You can watch it now, and it always has something to say about American culture. And you know, at the time it was made, I mean, you probably could not have made a big Hollywood studio movie with big stars that was a contemporary film about race and sex and violence and culture and all those things the way that The Searchers was. But it kind of, like, you could coat the pill by having it be a Western. And I think and I do think, in a way, Western's turning to revisionism. I mean, this is going way off topic, but Western's turning to revisionism, especially in the 70s and early 80s. I think part of the reason they became less, you know, palatable commercially was that kind of coating of the pill got, you know, the veneer got stripped away. I mean, and in a way, it's why I think Heaven's Gate was so poorly received when it came out and has aged so well now. I mean, I think that when that movie came out in 1980 and, you know, Reagan was, Reagan was elected president, and that was where the kind of the tenor was going in American culture. You know, nobody wanted to hear what Michael Cimino had to say about capitalism and about, you know, about us as a people with Heaven's Gate in 1980. And that, you know, granted, probably still not that many people want to hear about it, but
it is a long movie, Jim. It is a long
movie. It is. But I think it's a movie that has aged very, I mean, I've always been a champion of that movie, but I think, you know, it's aged very well. And anyway, I mean, it's an interesting thing about period movies. And All the President's Men is a very odd kind of period movie, because it is a period movie about a period that only took place a couple years before it was made. And that is, like, this kind of strange subgenre of American movies that, like I say, you know, Bombshell is one, a movie like that.
Social Network's
a movie like that. There's a few others, but they're not, you know, Soderbergh's The Laundromat is a movie like that, you know, to find an even more recent example. It's a very interesting and very tricky genre. And again, like I say, to me, it was that movie when I came across it in 1980 or whatever it was as an 8-year-old. I mean, it felt like ancient history to me. And watching it now, it feels like both. In some ways, it weirdly feels more recent, and in other ways, it feels to me like it might as well be
a millennium away.
Yeah. Because I just think, again, I want to believe in the things in that movie. And I just, you know, if you've heard my Increment Vice podcast, so you know I'm relatively pessimistic about the future of mankind. And I'm relatively pessimistic that, like, two guys like a Woodward and Bernstein today could possibly have the kind of impact. I mean, they couldn't. I mean, clearly they couldn't, because the president we have now here in America has done, you know, far crazier and more corrupt things than Nixon did, and everyone knows those things, and it doesn't matter. And that's a whole other issue, trying to figure out why it doesn't matter and why it doesn't have the, you know. But I mean, it's like, if Woodward and Bernstein printed that stuff today, people would fall asleep.
Well, speaking of two men attempting to change the world, just with the clarity of a couple of sentences, Jim and I are going to dive into the minute right now. We're going to watch it and listen along together. And then we're just going to keep this sprawling conversation, including, you know, really rightly so, the pessimism for not only journalism, but the state of mankind as we carry on. So, guys, have a listen along, and Jim and I will be back in just a second.
Me, I know exactly what I mean. Not here. I can't tell from this whether Hunt works for Coulson or Coulson works for Hunt.
May I have it?
Some of your conclusions.
May I have it? Yes, I'm not looking for a fight.
I'm not looking for a fight either. I'm just aware of the fact that you've only been here 9 months.
What has that got to do with anything?
Well, I've been in the business since I'm 16.
What are you saying?
Well, I'm trying to tell you that if you'd read mine and then read yours...
May I read yours?
Yeah. I walked by, gave yours a glance. It didn't look right, so I just figured I'd refine it a little. That first paragraph has to have more clarity. The reader's going to understand it. You don't mention Colson's name for the third paragraph. I think mine's better, but you go ahead and read it. If you think yours is better, we'll give yours to the desk. I've got Colson's name up front. He was a White House consultant, and nobody knows
right.
it.
Yours is better.
Jim, if you're going to do it right.
Indeed. And, you know, that scene brings out, visually that scene, and I know people are just listening to it, but it gets at something I was talking about earlier with the contrasts of Gordon Willis's cinematography, because a lot of the shots on Redford in that scene are a little below him, and you can see the ceiling with all of the sort of like glaring fluorescent lights above him and things like that. And I think that's another reason, like in this movie, again, going back to when I was a kid, I was so mesmerized by the deep throat scenes. And I think part of it is that because so much of the movie is under such glaring, blinding light, you know, this like harsh, unattractive office light. And then you get into those scenes in the parking garage and all you can see are like Hal Holbrook's eyes. And so you really like it, the contrast, you just lean in and it gives it so much more intrigue. And you know, that's something that just stands out at me about that scene. But something else about this scene,
the background actors, before we get to the content though, I just want to underscore reinforce your point of background actors who have something to do. Like there's a long-haired blonde guy who's sitting close to Bernstein, as in Hoffman, who walks over to his desk, picks up a piece of copy, walks away. There's a couple of people having a conversation, and these desks are weirdly, awkwardly uniform and sized in a way that if you're talking for long periods of time, people have that inclination to lean down because it is a noisy hubbub of activity. And so you see in the background, there's another journalist who goes over to someone who consulting over something, whether it's a copy desk or editorial, they get up, there's people moving in the background, there's groups of people coming out of a catch-up together. Like you said, there is something so effortless, and you can imagine him holding that to a high standard. It's like in American cinema, there's a couple of examples where you look at places and you completely forget that you're watching something that's false, something that's made up. And I think All the President's Men and like The Wedding and The Godfather are two of those things where I'm just like, this doesn't feel like anyone here is an actor. It feels like someone's at a party, and it feels like someone's at work. And so it's just such a strange, weird thing where you know someone's not in a real space. They're in an artificial space, but yet they're creating this like verite quality to everything that is being, you know, put in front of our eyes.
Yeah, I mean, you get the sense that Pakula or his AD or somebody gave every one of those people in the background a specific task or a specific goal. Said you're doing, you know, as opposed to like just, you know, a lot of times if you're on a film set and you watch how they stage the extras, it's just about, okay, you cross here and you cross here. And, you know, they're just telling people to walk back and forth in a way that kind of gives this illusion of activity, but doesn't really mean anything. And this gets at a whole, like, kind of theoretical question about what is realism in a movie. And because, again, there's this attitude, you know, I think like the Paul Greengrasses or the Peter Bergs of the world have one take on it, which is, you know, realistic means that the camera's handheld and, you know, it's that the frame is not like expertly composed and it looks messy and things like that. And again, it's a matter of personal taste, because to me, that's not the illusion of realism. To me, is actually created by sort of meticulous artifice in a way.
Yes.
And that's what you get from Pakula. And it's what you get from, say, you know, it's funny. You brought up Tarantino, and I was talking with him about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And because that's a movie where I think, you know, has a lot of great kind of background. The extras,
meticulous artifice is Quentin's bag. He loves it.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was saying that on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he had a lot of people who, like a lot of the extras in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, were not conventional extras. They were actually actors who he hired. You know, it's funny because in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, there's that whole line that Kurt Russell has where he's like, this isn't an Andy McLaughlin picture where I can pay people to just sit around and smoke cigarettes in case I might use them. But that's actually what Quentin does. He does do it like an Andy McLaughlin picture where he has like, he actually hired a group of actors who he kind of said, okay, I might use you some days, I might not. I just kind of want you around to throw you in a scene. And because he wanted the people in the background who were buying cigarettes or who were ordering a drink at Musso and Frank's behind Brad Pitt or whatever, you know, he wanted them to be playing characters, not just crossing to the camera to give the fake sense of hustle and bustle. And, you know, Pakula is really a master of that. I mean, his sense of detail is just, you know, it's exquisite. I mean, like, Pakula, I don't know what I would say his worst movie is, you know, but, like, his worst movie is a movie I would, if I made something a tenth as good, I'd feel like I could, you know, you know, Joel McRae says in Ride Thy Country, I could enter my house justified. If I made a movie, if I made a movie half as good as Consenting Adults or The Devil's Own, you know, I'd feel pretty good about it because he really, you know, the funny thing about Pakula is I think his reputation nowadays is kind of mostly rests on three movies. I mean, mostly Clute, Parallax View, and All the President's Men, all of which he did pretty close together. I mean, and to a certain degree, Sophie's Choice. But you know, it's like he kept making great, he made great stuff.
Oh my God.
You know, Presumed Innocent is, I think, one of the great American movies of the last 30, 40 years. I mean, it's another movie.
And in a Harrison Ford career of you know, iconic performances, it is his most underrated. It is probably 100%. His best character actor Harrison Ford performance. His and he did a few. He went through a big experimental phase where he was doing a lot of, you know, against type things. And, you know, I think that standing at the top of his pile is like Witness and Presumed Innocent as like two of his very, very, very best performances.
Yeah, I mean, Presumed Innocent is, and it also has that hypnotic quality that you talk about with Pakula. I mean, it's a very, and again, getting back to this whole thing about Pakula, how it's so weird how he does these things that shouldn't work but work better than the movies that do it the way you would think should work. Like, Presumed Innocent is a sort of in a way, it's like an erotic thriller with the least erotic guy in the history of cinema at its center. Like, Harrison Ford's character in that movie is so, it's like there's a line that Brian Dennehy has about him, how, you know, tightly wound he is. And he is, like, like Rusty Savage, the character Harrison Ford plays in Presumed Innocent, he is like this just stiff, like tightly wound, sort of repressed guy who is sexually obsessed. And, like, he's like the opposite of, like, Michael Douglas in Basic Instinct. You know, like, Michael Douglas in Basic Instinct is, like, all testosterone. You know, the guy, like, walks on screen, he's practically, like, gonna pull his dick out of his pants at any given point. Harrison Ford in Presumed Innocent is exactly opposite, and yet that movie is so seductive and so sensual. And again, a lot of it does have to, it's, you know, also, I believe, shot by Gordon Willis, and just, yeah, really, really amazing, amazing, amazing movie. And
For folks who are listening and you wouldn't have heard it, Jim, yet, because as we're recording it today, you haven't heard the episode. But Liz Hanna, who's the co-writer of The Post, who worked with Spielberg on The Post, was on set one day with Mr. Spielberg and was watching, you know, one of the setups, you know, get crafted, and they were getting ready to shoot. And she just gave a compliment, and she's like, oh, this is a very, very Pakula shot, you know, because they're both clearly fans. And, you know, her recounting the tale of Spielberg looking at her and going, thank you, and taking that as like a monstrous compliment is like, is no mean feat. Like, when you're talking about who's a huge fan.
Well, it's funny because I forgot all about The Post, but now that you bring it up, I mean, that is actually another movie. You know, Spielberg is the master of, like, moving people around in the frame and sort of, you know, again, another movie that is just a lot of, like, people talking in offices and rooms and things like that. And he's so good at making it cinematic, and he's so good at background detail and all that kind of stuff. So it's so, I mean, it's, it's so funny that I just for some reason I totally forgotten all about The Post, thinking about these kind of newsroom movies and stuff. And
no,
it's,
but
it's
the newsroom, the different quality is, I think, you know, the Post kind of does that, has that weird slippage because it's almost of its time and ahead of its time, and it kind of got overlooked, you know, because it became a movie that was in direct dialogue with like the presidential election. You know, it was in direct dialogue with it, and it kind of slipped past. But it's like, it's definitely one of those movies that was intending to create dialogue, and it's in his sort of purple patch of these recent American historical-based sort of dramas or dramatizations, and all very high quality. You know, Bridge of Spies, Lincoln.
Yeah.
Like, they're well, all
so yeah, it's terrific. So funny, if he had made that movie, I feel like if The Post had come out a year later in a way, it probably would have resonated more with people. It was almost, you're right, I think he was almost a little bit...
It was almost ahead of the curve. Yeah, like if it's 1 year later, it's a it's so strange. But I want to get back to your point because this is really interesting. You know, you're a film historian, so this is what's critically important. Is I've always been fascinated, and it was since like early research at university in Oz around, you know, the considerations of like primary and secondary sources. So when you're looking at cinema and or like, you know, pop cultural cinema as like reflecting, you know, sentiments of the time or of the filmmakers of the time, etc. I think what's really strange, All the President's Men has this weird relationship in that even prior to Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein actually developing their book pitch, you know, Redford is a powerhouse superstar in Hollywood and is talking to these guys while they're doing the reporting and saying, you guys have to make a book and I want to do the movie. I want the rights to it. And then for a movie to be released on January 1st, ish 1976, right in the midst of Oscar season, to be considered and for Academy members to really digest it and have like a wide impact. You know, they've got to be producing that all through the year in 1975 and into 74, all the way up until the guys are producing their final days reporting and Nixon is actually impeached. So it is a really strange relationship and orbit that this film has around the actual real events. And to your point, talking about like that fastidious detail that is off, out of the frame or in the frame that's not the focus of the frame, that this movie has a weird relationship with. Because, you know, the fact that it's then... and it's so in everyone's consciousness. There's really not any other movie that almost ever, like maybe The Social Network now, people will look back on and go, you know, it was almost too soft. You know, it was almost too soft because it was so on the cusp. You know, it's not the guy, you know, Sorkin and Fincher didn't have the luxury of the Cambridge Analytica scandal to talk about what cultural impact it was going to have. And even Bombshell's focus on the Fox News era almost feels like it's, again, that proximity either helps or hinders it. Who knows? It's one of those things where it and The Post feel like they've got a close relationship. So I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on that because it's so strange when you're making a movie based on facts and you're working with the people who it's based on to get the rights to the story to do it while it's happening. Like it becomes this weird, messy, almost incestuous production thing, but in fact it ends up working so beautifully.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that shocked me when I was a kid, and when I learned that basically, you know, because I always assumed the way without really thinking it through, and because you think through the timeline, and this would be impossible, but I always assumed that it was kind of your typical situation where, you know, when you're adapting a book, where it's like the book came out, was popular, Redford and William Goldman and Pakula adapted it, and made a movie. Like, I was very surprised to learn of the kind of the Redford actually kind of had an influence on the construction of the book, you know, that it was like that he and that the book was being written, you know, that he was kind of monitoring the writing of the book and in touch with them. And it was all kind of he was thinking about this movie concurrently with them writing the book. I mean, that was always kind of very, very fascinating to me. And I think the fact that it all worked so well, I mean, I think you really have to give a lot of credit to Redford as a producer on this movie, not just the star.
Big because time. What, even, you know, more than being the star, I mean, which I think is possibly one of his best performances, but most definitely as a producer. Like, there's maybe no one who's had more power and influence at the time than him.
I mean for no, you know, obviously he's responsible for a number of ways, I mean, in a number of ways. I mean, there's no way in hell Warner Brothers, you know, nobody really wanted to make this movie at like the studio level. But it's like, well, you know, Redford was on such a hot streak. I mean, this period of his career you know, within a few years, he had The Way We Were and The Sting and, you know, even movies.
Butch Cassidy movies and Sundance.
Yeah. I mean, even movies he was doing that were kind of, you know, not as successful, like Great Gatsby, still were moneymakers, you know. I mean, he was very, very, he was like, you know, one of the biggest movie stars in the world. So if he wanted to do it, you know, they were going to kind of hold their nose and do it. But in terms of the detail and the research, I mean, he was, by all accounts, you know, just a rabid, researcher himself. I mean, much more so than Goldman. I mean, you know, Goldman, I don't want to make it my life's mission to brag on William Goldman. I was just on this another podcast where he came up, and I was kind of, you know, I find Goldman to be, I was talking about how overrated I think he is. And I do. I mean, I think, I think he gets a lot of credit for a lot of things that are not necessarily his, and All the President's Men is exhibit A. I mean, I mean, by all accounts, you know, no one was really very happy with Goldman's script. I mean, Pecula and Redford certainly weren't. And then there was this whole crazy thing. I don't know if you've talked about this on your podcast yet, because once I knew I was going to be on, I stopped listening because I was afraid it would paralyze me if I heard about too many other people talking. So if you've already talked about this, I apologize, but you know, there's this whole weird, like, then, you know, Goldman wrote his drafts that nobody was really happy with. And then there was this whole sort of weird side thing where Carl Bernstein and Nora Ephron, who he was married to at the time, without telling anybody they were going to do it, they kind of wrote their own draft that then they gave to Redford and Pecula, that also was not liked. And then essentially Redford and Pecula kind of, you know, heavily rewrote the script themselves. And Redford did a lot of the real legwork in terms of talking to a lot of the people involved. I mean, really kind of doing the same sort of work his character does in the movie, just, you know, doing a lot of the kind of firsthand research that evidently Goldman didn't really do. And so I think you have to, you know, again,
we haven't gone into that detail. So I was just letting you absolutely go there. And I think that there has been some sort of internet sleuthing in the past around what was there, what wasn't there. And I think where it sort of landed is, you're absolutely right, Goldman did a script that ultimately won the best screenplay. And it wasn't, you know, what they sort of found is that, like, sort of 70 to 80%, let's say, of the script was Goldman's, and the structure, most importantly, was there. But you're right that you look at Goldman as a figure, and he's a master. He had much more of an influence as a mentor, almost,
right,
arguably, you could say, than, and with his most influential films on an emerging crop of filmmakers like a David Fincher or an Aaron Sorkin, et cetera, who had huge careers, and you know, were so deeply influenced by every part of his work. But it's really interesting. It's like that you cannot understate the importance of a director and having a direct influence on the text, because someone like a Pecula and a Redford being so in charge of it, it's like the script being there, and then having a Hoffman, who is a noted improviser, and Redford, who is the producer, and those guys working and collaborating on a style. Like, the script can only do so much when you get all those collaborators on the ground. Like, it's going to be a foundation. Yes, it's going to be great, but there's going to be so much more in the organic chemistry of what is actually created on set. And in such a weird way, too, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein are involved in the film production. So they're, like, there. It's like these real guys are there. Oh, what did you say? Or what would you say? Like, these small details that may have escaped the script don't miss the final product, because these guys are right there to sort of, you know, continue to arbiter over its quality as they're developing it.
Well, it's such an interesting movie in terms of the auteur theory, because, like, you know, I'm a big believer to a certain extent.
Oh, Jim, and I are both what they call vulgar auteurists. So I think we can happily say that.
But at the same time, I mean, it is an interesting, you know, All the President's Men is an interesting movie in that it's one of those movies that has laser focus and has a very, very clear point of view, both literary and visually, but is the product of so many different voices. And I mean, I do think at the end of the day, a lot of credit has to go to Redford for kind of pulling them all together. But I mean, because you do look at that movie and it's like, obviously, it's now a Pecula movie, but it's also, like,
a Robert Redford movie.
It's a Robert Redford movie. It's a Gordon Willis movie. I mean, it's one of those movies. There's some movies where I feel like you could take out certain key creative forces and replace them with someone else, and the movie would not be fundamentally changed. I mean, All President's Men, with a different cinematographer other than Gordon Willis, that's a totally different
movie. Yeah, no, you can't take any of the ingredients. You know, like a tour de force, like a Quentin, and although he and his relationship with like Bob Richardson has been so gargantuan, you can see Quentin as a guy who has such a singular voice and such a singular vision as a director. Yeah. Of like he puts the camera everywhere. He's like a Soderbergh who's like hovering on that camera and being intently sort of doing it. You can see that maybe with a different cinematographer, he might have a same or similar result. And that's no offense to Robert Bob Richardson's style. He's such an effective, stylistic sort of. He can take stylistic pivots because he's worked with people like Oliver Stone and Quentin Tarantino, mm-hmm. and you know all those sorts of huge personalities and as directors. But I agree with you. If you take this book is so this book's adaptation into a film is so perilously balanced on the alchemy of all of these different ingredients.
Yeah.
That. You know, you take any of them out, any of the stars, like all the way to Robards, all the way to the bookkeeper, you know, like you take these people out and it just, something is different and something doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, I 100%. And I mean, that's a perfect way to put it, is it's the alchemy of it. I mean, it's somehow all the right elements were there. And again, I think you have to give a certain amount of credit to Redford as a producer, because I also think he, you know, he's the guy who kind of forced it through all the way. I mean, even into, you know, the editing. I mean, Pakula was kind of notoriously a guy who would sort of go through self-doubt in the editing room and things like that. And Redford was kind of the guy in this movie who was like, we got to pull this thing together. It's not gonna be ready for release if we don't get this thing, you know, going. And it's funny because Redford, it's a com, you know, Redford was, I mean, I guess it was inevitable that he was going to eventually turn to directing, because it's a common thread in movies of this period with him, this whole thing where of him being a sort of co-auteur and there being these sort of multiple auteurs on one movie. Like I was just thinking, I just watched Jeremiah Johnson again recently, and that's a really weird movie. It's a great movie, but it's like a weird movie in the sense that you've got these voices that like theoretically shouldn't really be compatible, but are. Like you've got, so it's written by John Milius, directed by Sidney Pollack. And those two guys have totally different sensibilities. And yet the movie works really well as both a John, it's a full on John Milius movie, and it's a full on Sidney Pollack movie, and it's a full on Robert Redford movie. But you know, anyway, it's this one. Yeah. It's just, it's really fascinating. And I mean, I just think, you know, Goldman, I just find it funny. You know, Goldman, I think is, you know, he's like a master self-promoter, but he's like one of those guys. I think part of my beef with him is, and look, obviously the guy has written, you know, he wrote some of my favorite movies, Marathon Man fan. I mean, I don't think Butch Cassidy, you can't, but like, you know, he always, you know, he's like one of these guys, like he's one of these guys, I think living in and working in Hollywood, I find that there's still, you know, people still quote the dumb things he wrote in the 70s as though they're gospel. And it kind of like, you know, and I mean, I'm old enough to remember when he had his dopey Premiere magazine column where he would pontificate about movies and write these like self-serving. I remember like the Christmas of 1990.
The big picture book assembles those things. And it's what is fascinating. I love it. I'm not going to argue the dopiness. I'm actually a fan of it, but I love that it's like that nobody knows anything is such an... It's such an overarching statement that takes away the context of like the time in which he bloomed, because what that nobody knows anything ethos is so indicative of like that transition from like classic Hollywood to new Hollywood and then back out into the post-Reagan Hollywood era of like, you know, blockbusters and Spielberg and those sorts of things, that it's such a weird thing of like nobody knows anything. Yeah, of course, because you like each era of movies redefines movies. Like,
And
I love also all of the Oscar predictions, because nearly all of them in that book, which is great, because if you're reading the column live, you didn't get this. But if you're reading the book, how wrong a lot of them are.
That's really funny. Yeah, I never read the book, but I read the columns as they were coming out, and I just I just remember the one he wrote at Christmas of 1990, where he was handicapping all the movies that were coming out in 1990 and at Christmas time. And one of them was Misery, which he wrote. And it's like Misery is listed as like, oh, this is one of the promising ones. This is going to be one of the great ones. And it's like, well, of course you're going to say that. And meanwhile, he's like ragged on De Palma and all these people. And anyway, I don't know. I don't know why I have such a beef with William Goldman.
I do have friends of the show that remind me that this is the guy who wrote Dreamcatcher. So that's their usual.
Probably one of my three or four favorite movies he ever had anything to do with, but that's for another podcast.
Oh, that is a huge. That is definitely for another podcast. Look.
Something I wanted to get back to about the minute that we watched is that particular minute also I think speaks to another part of the appeal of All the President's Men, which is that. It is in its way the closest it comes to being a quote unquote commercial genre movie is as a kind of buddy movie, you know. And I do think that like that's you know the casting of Hoffman and Redford opposite each other in that movie is just it's so perfect. And you know, originally Redford thought about Pacino for that role, and obviously Pacino. You know, fantastic actor, probably would have been great, but I don't know. There's just something about Hoffman's, about his nervous energy opposite Redford's kind of rock solid, I don't know how to phrase it exactly, but you know what I'm saying?
They complement each other so perfectly. Yeah, Redford is effortless confidence. He's just so sure and deliberate in every decision that he's making. Yeah. And you can see in Hoffman, I love what you said there, is like a nervous energy that Pacino doesn't have. Because if you look at the same contrasting periods, other than really the incredible, incredible Dog Day Afternoon, he's not doing as much of that nervous, kinetic stuff. What he's doing is having these characters that exude this presence that is bigger than his physical, like, makeup. Like, he's exuding something big. You know, Michael Corleone, of course. Serpico, of course. So you see these roles where he feels like he's bigger. But that deliberate... And almost like in posture as well, that deliberate sort of straight and strong and sturdy Redford movie star ashore, like he's the rudder that is steering this ship, and Hoffman's more kinetic, bouncy energy. Like they link in so perfectly. Like you need it. And the other technique that they talk about famously is learning each other's lines to step over each other's sentences when they're interacting with other people is just such a deft touch of like, this is the perfect collaboration, you know, like who would have thought of that? It's just, it adds to that.
Yeah, that's a brilliant idea. I would love to try to steal that someday for something if it worked. It's such a good idea. And it's interesting too, the way they play those characters in that movie, because, you know, there's this superficial sense that Hoffman's character, you know, like Hoffman's character is kind of the, you know, Bernstein is like the, I don't know if shameless is the right word, but like, he's the guy who's just going to go for the story no matter what. Like Redford's character Woodward, you know, he'll have these moments where seems quote unquote more of a conscience. Like there's that scene where they're talking to their coworker who was engaged to the guy they need information
from Sally,
and she says, you know, and Redford's the one who says, you know, forget it, we don't want you to do anything you're uncomfortable with. But in fact, you know, as you watch the movie more closely, you realize that he's kind of, that's all about, to a certain degree, a ruse. Like he is pretending to be the good cop, but he's really the guy.
It's Kay Eddie is the character's name, and it's Lindsay Kress. Oh, okay. I wanted to correct to make sure Sally Aitken is another character. I just wanted to be really
okay.
Deliberate.
Good. Right. Well. So yeah, the character Lindsay Kress from Slapshot plays. You know, Redford's character, as you watch it, there's just the dynamic between the two of them, and this goes back to that thing of yours about them learning each other's lines. There is this kind of ping-ponging back and forth between who is really kind of the master manipulator of people, because really Redford's character, Woodward, is, you know, he's actually kind of going for the throat as much as Bernstein is, but his way of going for the throat is acting like he's not going for the throat. And then that's how he kind of gets the Lindsay Kross character to actually give him what he wants. And that is a perfect
moment in this movie, about the way that he goes about that. But it's in this minute, there's one moment I want to bring up. It's like, this is the most annoyed I think we see Woodward even get the most rise out of him, and it's not in the words that he says. It's when he snatches the new version of the copy. It's like the one time in this entire movie where conflict, where that personal conflict, and you feel like this would be a huge crescendo in a contemporary movie, like someone would really underscore that they wanted this conflict and they want to sort of, you know, make their relationship more problematic or unnecessarily overdramatic. But all it is like, I'm annoyed, and he reads it. And what's so great is how quickly he returns back to center. Like, it's actually Bernstein and Hoffman freaking out a bit around, you know, oh, you know, he's going to be really insulted. He's like, no, yours is better. Yours is better. And that's it.
Yeah. It's funny, all the little moments, all the little differences between the two of them in the movie, how kind of minor and underplayed they are. Like the scene where Redford reveals that he's a Republican and Hoffman just kind of gives him that funny look.
Wonderful.
And, you know, and it's, and again, I think it's, again, gets at what makes the movie so compelling and hypnotic is this sense that you almost have to constantly lean in watching it. Whereas if it was made, you know, most filmmakers, like you say, would play up that conflict more. And in a weird way, it wouldn't be as compelling. Like, it's more compelling because it's so much just like in Redford's body language, as opposed to them having some big blow up over it. It is just the way he snatches the paper back and the way his whole body kind of tenses up and everything. And it's, you know, it's a cliche to say like that filmmakers of that era trusted the audience more or something, but that is, you know, Pakula is kind of interesting because he does trust the audience more, and yet he's also very, very manipulative. And I mean that as a comp, like in a good way, like in a way that, say, you know, Robert Altman wasn't, you know, it's one of the things I think makes Pakula one of the all-time greats. And I think, and what makes, like, you know, Pakula, when he did have content that was sort of more overtly dramatic, like a Sophie's Choice or a Presumed Innocent, I mean, he could really, really go to town. He was really, you know, because he was such a great kind of master manipulator with his camera.
Well, look, Jim, I unlike my co-star on One Heat Minute Productions, Travis Woods, I'm not trying to beat the running time of All the President's Men with our first conversation. But what I'm going to say is that I'm going to need you to come back. I need you to come back on the show at some point, because I think there's so much more that I want to talk about. I do welcome any opinions of William Goldman that are different from the gush that is going to abound in this show. So thank you for that.
Well, too. And again, I'm being a bit of a contrarian because of that. Like, I'm sort of, it isn't, I mean, you know, before like people come after me on Twitter or something like that, I mean, you know, I being like, who the hell is this idiot? This guy who, you know, who's this guy who wrote a low budget Hercules movie to be ragging on William Goldman? He's written several of my favorite movies of all time. Clearly a major talent. I will go to my grave defending Dreamcatcher, actually, as an underrated American movie. So, I mean, I am, to a certain degree, I'm a fan of his. I think his canonization, as though he's like this sort of high priest of American screenwriting and makes these proclamations from the mountain and stuff, you know, I like to push back against that a little bit. It's just, again, it's the contrarian in me, I suppose. The same side of me that thinks Dreamcatcher is a great movie, I guess.
It's the Gen X. You know, a friend of 1 8 Minute Productions, Sean Burns, says, you know, as a kid who grew up in the 80s, largely, we got taught to distrust things that everyone liked and conventional wisdom. And so it makes sense now that in 2020, reflectively, when people talk about conventional wisdom, to still somewhat rail against it. But that's okay. But also, I think you say something that's really important, which is, you know, there are some films that, you know, and I think this is where you talk about the alchemy of All the Presidents and Goldman, is if you look at the script of, say, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which I think is his best written script, that script is a damned blueprint that if followed, like, is such a blueprint that if followed, like, there was no way the movie was not going to be successful. as right. per the script. Whereas I think what you came up with, which is, you know, what people, even as great as the wonderful and iconic Pauline Kael, were wrestling with something like Citizen Kane, is like the alchemy of who is steering a movie as an auteur is still something to be debated. And there are certain movies that there's no need for debate, because in All the President's Men, it's about Pakula, it's about Willis, it's about Redford, it's about Bernstein and Woodward themselves, and it's about the conflict of Goldman from a structural perspective that adds all that, you know, it's not all a seamless thing. It's sometimes a dialogue and a bit of a wrestle, but that wrestle ultimately, you know, created the pressure to make this diamond that we continue to revisit, that not only meant a lot to the people in 1976 who first watched it, that not only meant a lot, you know, at the time of when it was based, you know, in sort of, you know, 72 onwards, but it means and continues to mean a lot with every single revisit that we take with it as audience members and as people who are, you know, are continuing to wrestle with it and keep going back to it reflexively, because it's a balm, because it's just so great, because it's effortless, you know, all those things. I think it make it so special.
I agree completely.
A huge thank you to my incredible guest, Jim Hemphill. What a mind. I cannot wait to get him back onto the show at a later date. If you want to follow Jim, the best place to find him is at Jimmy Hemphill, at JIMMYHEMPHILL on Twitter. You can find him there, and it's jimhemphillfilms.com to find all his other stuff. He's a great follow, a historian, and in this time of COVID-19, he won't be doing as many Q&As, so reach out to him on the Twitters, but we'll definitely have him back on the show as soon as we can manage it. He is an absolute treasure. Thank you so much again for listening to All the President's Minutes and anything on the One Heat Minute Productions feed. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and producer of Increment Vice, as well as everything that's been happening on the One Heat Minute Productions feed. If you want to follow me, simply go to @OneBlakeMinute on Instagram and on Twitter, or to OneHeatMinute.com to find out everything that's happening with the show and about the show. If you guys want to support us, we have a link on OneHeatMinute.com to our Patreon. If you can spare even a couple of bucks a month, the cost of a coffee a month, you are going to be contributing to this show, the amazing Increment Vice, and any other amazing shows that are a part of One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much in advance. If you can't support us, you don't have the cash, that's totally fine, but please subscribe, rate, review, and share the shows. We would love, if you are digging the show, share them with like-minded film folk around the place. Thank you so much once again for listening to this episode. We'll catch you on another episode of All the President's Minutes and another episode in the One Heat Minute Productions feed. Very soon.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.